was make me begin to look much deeper into what my practice, my Zen practice, is really about as it operates in my life. Are we getting feedback? One of the and various words we use all the time in Zen kept hitting me as being particularly puzzling. If you really look at them, you can use them endlessly in a kind of casual way, but if you really begin to look at it, you see it's very confusing. And one of these words is the way. What does that mean? Sometimes, of course, the word originally is the Tao, and it comes from Taoism. And it means basically there, the way the universe actually works, the law of nature or of the universe. It doesn't quite mean that in Zen. Well, what does it mean? We sometimes translate the word as the road. That's why I like the open road. Way sounds a little unfamiliar to our normal way of speaking. We would probably say the road. This is the road. Now, that's where the confusion sets in. We generally think of a road or a way or a path as going from here to there. And it's already established. So is that what we're talking about? You know, the Buddha once said that he had not invented himself this path, this way. He had found an ancient path that was overgrown, and he cleared it and made it available to people to use. And that's how in early Buddhism the word was usually used. It meant there is a particular laid out road. And if you follow this road and you do what you're supposed to do along this road, you will wind up in where? Not Petaluma. In Nirvana. Now, when we get to Zen, Zen doesn't like that. It says, no, 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 no. That's not the way it is. Jisho has called this, she got the expression from somebody, I forget who she said it was, that it's what is known as the off-ramp. The Nirvana off-ramp. Let's just get out of life altogether. Let's just end it. Let's reach the end of the road and what? So, but that's what in our minds, too much, this metaphor of the road leads us to believe. Well, another way you could look at it is, okay, but you don't have to look at that kind of a laid out road as ending in just death, of just disappearing, like the early Buddhists did. But so there's another way you can look at that too. But another way you can look at it is there's this vast unfolding universe out there in front of you, and you're creating a path as you walk it. As you have to climb over this rock, go around that tree, and maybe somebody has given you a set of guidelines, advice, wisdom about this is the best way to negotiate such a path, one that you're creating yourself. Well, which is it? What is it we're talking about? That's the question that I got into. And even further, whatever kind of path it is, how do we negotiate this path? A path is something you walk, or you drive, or you ride a horse, but it's an active thing. You know, the other image that appears a lot in Buddhism is the river. But the river is kind of a passive image, like you, well, go with the flow kind of thing. You just, oh, that's just the way it is. Well, that's not Buddhism at all. But nonetheless, that's what the image of a flowing river is apt to bring up in us. So I like the word the way, the road, better, because you know that there's, if there's a road there, or that you're creating a road, you can't just sit on your rear end and expect to negotiate that path. At some point, you've got to get up and physically walk it, ride over it, whatever, negotiate it in some way. And Zen says, yes, that's the way. That's the way. But how do you negotiate this way with equanimity, with gratitude, with compassion, with joyousness? How do you walk this road in this positive way that I'm talking about, and not just see the road as, you know, in Christianity, the road has a tendency to mean the road that Christ walked during the Passion, with the cross on his back and being beaten. This life is this suffering that you have to negotiate to get to, again, some kind of nirvana at the end. But that's not our way. Our way is, how do you do this joyously? How do you walk this path joyously? Well, there's a wonderful koan in the Gateless Gate, the Empty Gate, Mumon Khan, that tackles this. And I'm going to read the koan to you, and then we'll see where we can go from there. And this may seem like a pretty, like all koans, pretty opaque when you first hear it, but actually it's clear as a bell once you catch on to what's going on here. So just don't try to figure it out as you hear it. Let your discriminating mind decide and just let it in. A monk asked Master Qian Feng, "The blessed ones of the ten directions have one road to nirvana. Where is the road?" Qian Feng raised his staff, drew a line, and said, "Here." Subsequently, the monk asked Master Yunmen for further instruction. Yunmen held up a fan and said, "This fan leaps up to the 33rd heaven and bumps into the nose of the chief of the celestial rulers. The carp of the eastern sea are given a blow, and it rains buckets." Wow, how different can you be? Anyhow, the compiler of the this koan book, Yunmen, wrote a little verse about this, and he said, "You've already arrived before you take a step. It's already explained before a word is said. Even if you keep on top of the situation with every move, still you should know there's an opening higher beyond." Well, what may confuse you here is this monk's one road of nirvana. How do you get there? How do you find this one road that leads to nirvana? And here we're beginning to use nirvana in a totally different way. And I'll explain that in a minute. When you've got a head full of ideas about what nirvana is, where you want to get with your life, what is good, what is bad, all these things, how do you find this road to nirvana in the midst of your usual confusion. And this confused state we're normally in, where we already think we know everything. We don't know, but we know. How do we negotiate the path or find it in the midst of this confusion? Well, first off, nirvana is not a place. It's not someplace you wind up at. Nirvana is the way a person experiences his life, if he experiences it from what we can blithely call enlightened mind. In other words, an enlightened person experiences life, just ordinary everyday life, whatever it is, as nirvana. And that's the Zen understanding of nirvana. Again, I think that's probably confusing. Well, what sets apart a person who's, again, our discriminating mind starts fiddling with this. What sets apart a person who experiences his life as nirvana from one who doesn't? In other words, we sneak back into that old question, well, what is enlightenment? What does it mean to be enlightened? Well, whatever it means, it definitely does not mean this off-ramp from life, obviously. Hakuin Zenji, a great Japanese Zen master, in one of his poems says, this very place is the lotus land. That's another way of saying this very place, right here, right now, is nirvana. So where is it? That monk asked. Where is this one road? Now, Yun Men said, look at the other side. This one guy said, right here, this is the road to nirvana. Right here. This one moment of here and now is the road to nirvana. But Yun Men said, wait just a minute. Let's look at the other side of that. And in Zen, the secret of Zen, by the way, if you want to know, is that you always have to keep both sides in mind at one time. There's never one side. And that's how these koans are often set up. They trick you into thinking you've got to choose. They'll give you two options, and you've got to choose. And the minute you choose, you've fallen flat on your face. But anyhow, Yun Men said, don't be one-sided. And he made his fan do this fan dance. The Sally Rand of Zen masters. Doing the fan dance. But anyhow. So what he's saying is the one way road to nirvana is everywhere. You can't get off of it. You don't have to be, we can say, yes, well, you need to be right here, right now, to be on the road, but you don't. You're on the road right now, whether you know it or not. And that road is leading you to nirvana. It's everywhere. There's no limits. This is seeing the road in the second way I talked about, as there's just this vast universe out there, and wherever you walk, you're creating the road. That is nirvana. It's just living your life. And yet, is that right? Then why don't we know it? Why don't we know that this life, moment by moment, or this life just stepping off into the complete unknown, wherever it leads, is nirvana. I like something that Eiken Roshi said about this. By the way, I don't think there's an answer to this. Don't think you're going to get an answer. I like very much what Eiken Roshi had to say about this. He said, "These two old worthies joined hands to show eternity," and he quotes, this is a quote from William Blake, "eternity is in love with the productions of time." How this gesture at this moment includes heaven and earth, past, present, and future. And that is our practice, our purpose, and our realization. In other words, what Eiken Roshi is pointing out here is that it's in everything and it's in one thing. And it's in everything and it's in one thing. And when you're truly practicing, that's your path. You're just right here, right now, but you're open to the entire universe. That's the road to nirvana. So, I ask you, I used the word, which again is confusing, equanimity a little earlier. Is it the equanimity of nirvana, or is it the aliveness of things just as they are? In other words, is it this quietness out of which everything is arising, or is it everything in this moment right here? And I also ask you, how do you choose between these? Well, if you choose, you lose. You have to be able to experience, the Zen experience is experiencing both of these ways of looking at the road at the same time, of being right here, right now, and at the same time, completely open to whatever is occurring. The whole universe. Equanimity is how you experience your life. You know, you can either experience it as this unfolding and amazing and wondrous universe, or you can experience your life as being put upon by all these problems. Oh, life is so difficult and there's all these problems. How do you experience your life? Well, if you experience it only in that second way, you don't have any equanimity in your life. And because all that means is that you experience your life non-dualistically. You accept the fact that there is no just one road, even though at any one moment there is just one road. Do you understand what I'm saying? This is a hard one, but it's crucial, because otherwise we put ourselves into a box with our practice. We actually use our practice to close us down, and people commonly fall into this. Or people say, oh, just what does it matter? I don't need to practice. It's all right here, right now. Whatever you do, that's it. Well, there's a truth in both of those. Either of them by itself is a trap. You have to experience your life from both of those points of view. So, how do you act in any particular situation? That's the question, real question, isn't it, that we have. How do I act? What is right action? What is right behavior in any particular moment that we're living in this unfolding, puzzling universe? Good luck. Any questions?
Only 3,422.
Yeah. Sure, we started out saying that, you know, this question was most alive for you as you've been addressing your outpatient and your chemo and all.
Yeah.
How have you been using it in particular?
Well, because whenever I think that, you know, at any particular moment, you can, if you fall into concentrating too much on that side, what if this moment is very painful and uncomfortable? And you go, oh, this is life. Which is not the right way to meet that. I mean, you don't have to meet pain and discomfort and sickness and approaching death and things like that. With that attitude, you discover that if you look at it closely, because at the same time, maybe at this moment, it's a painful moment, but there's this entire journey still to pursue, and you never know what's coming up next. And maybe it's an unspeakably beautiful moment with a person. You know what I mean. Everybody knows what that means. So I think that in extreme conditions, sometimes you discover the truth of this koan, that you're just right here, right now, and everything is just unspeakably strongly experienced. But at the same time, you're sitting in the midst of an entire universe that's unfolding, and it's wondrous. And why are you hung up in the fact that you've got some sadness in your life at this moment? That's just one taste. Anything else?
I have a question about what you just said. There's being hung up, and then there's actually experiencing. And I'm wondering if you can comment on that, because it seems to me that a lot of sadness, particularly in our culture, but it's the one I know the best, is repressed. And there's this grief that isn't actually experienced. So there seems to be some balance between not getting attached or hung up to your story, you know, how life is supposed to be, but also actually experiencing whatever that emotion or reality is that arises, even when it's unpleasant or very painful or sad.
Well, you know, when I said that equanimity basically means existing non-dualistically, well, the problem comes in is that we hold back. You know, when you grieve, you should just grieve. I mean, cry and carry on. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. When you're happy, really be happy. But we're always hedging our bets. And we care way too much what other people think, you know, about us. So we can't just really grieve in our culture. We can't just really be happy. We can't just really do what we're doing with complete attention and just really into it. No, because, there's this, there's that. Or that's not right. We shouldn't, you know, you get too involved in something, you're going to get hurt. You give your heart to somebody, you're going to get hurt. There's always a reason why we can't just, the word that I like very much that's used in Zen for this, wholeheartedly live our lives. So then, you know, like you say, then we sit on our life, and then our life is full of unexpressed feelings that tend to weigh on us and eat us up. Is that...
No, thank you.
Equanimity is not, I'm fascinated by that word because, boy, it's so easy to misunderstand. It's not a matter of finding this perfectly balanced position and then sitting there like you're a stone Buddha or a metal Buddha. That's too much, I think, the way we tend to think of equanimity. No, equanimity means it's like a dance. You're, you know, I remember one time I used the, I had, at one point I was in a way, way back in time, I was in a play where on the stage we had to do, it was a ballroom scene or something like that, the Viennese Waltz. Have you ever done the Viennese Waltz? Well, what it is falling down. You're constantly falling down. You step back, let go, and as you do, you spin. And that keeps you upright, and plus you and your partner supporting each other. But otherwise, you're just falling down all the time. It's always falling and catching your equilibrium, falling. That's why it's exciting. Dance to do. Well, that's life. That's life. You know, when you walk, actually you fall. That, you know, humans were really had to make a huge adjustment when they began to walk just on their hind limbs. And we're very unsteady in that position, very unsteady. That's why we like to lay down. So much. Let's just lay down and go to sleep. Because walking is basically, you step forward, you fall, and you find your balance again. That's life. And that's real equanimity. That's being able to live in both of these worlds at one time. Anything else? Yeah.
And then where does this, I see what you're talking about, that you know, you're living in sadness or whatever. Where does anxiety fall into all of this? Because it seems like a lot of people in response to this respond with anxiety, and that can be really controlling and damaging.
Well, yeah. You know, anxiety is one, I think, perfectly good translation of dukkha, where we translate as suffering. As that's been suggested, it's really a little too narrow, but it's a big part of what we often mean by suffering. Well, it's a feeling that, I think what that is we've been trained to think that we have to do everything right. And if we don't, we're going to be punished. That's what I think. I think anxiety is a response to feeling that if we don't get it all under control, it's all going to get away from us. Isn't that basically it? It's always getting away from me. My life's getting away from me. And, you know, there's enormous numbers of people now out there on anti-anxiety drugs. I was amazed at that. I heard about that the other day, that people, I guess huge numbers of people nowadays live in great anxiety. A good reason to have a meditation practice. Because I think that's exactly what you see when you sit down, is that this anxiety you're experiencing doesn't really have anything to do with the reality of this moment. There may be places where anxiety is the right response, but not in the way that people experience it in their lives nowadays. It's this thing that rides them.
So, on the same level as anxiety, is hope the same kind of thing? It's just opposite. Like, if anxiety is in general, abstractly representing a negative thing about something that hasn't occurred yet, then is hope the same thing?
You know, I never really thought about it that way, but it could be. That is, at least it would be a way maybe of trying to deal with anxiety, of reverse it into, oh well, it's all going to work out okay in the end, kind of thing. Yeah, maybe it is just the other side of the anxiety coin. Yeah, that's possible. Yeah.
So then my personal question is that that leaves my life, no, that leaves me feeling kind of a flat, because that only leaves the here and now without any attachments to either past or future.
Yeah.
You have to be very, very busy engaging in here and now.
Well, I think not so much being busy, but being awake to what is here and now. And because what is here and now, you know, is all of life, is right here, right now. If you're awake to that, then maybe you don't need to fall into anxiety about, am I going to be able to negotiate this without falling on my face, or without some tiger I don't know exists who's standing right behind me getting ready to eat me. On the other hand, or without having to think, well, the only way that I can deal with all this is to be hopeful about the future. No, I think if you're truly, we got to watch out for that expression here and now, because it's been overused, you know, and it, I think that tends to be misleading too. The future and the past are included right here, right now. But I think if we're kind of awake and aware of what's going on, really going on right now, not what's going on in our head, but what's really going on, this anxiety and all these stuff that is just in our head is relieved. There's no room for it. I mean, you know, that's just a play that's being acted out in our imagination. Not that it doesn't feel real. Okay, well, I've got some announcements.